apologize for the delay. We have a caucus meeting that is just adjourned, and members will be coming shortly. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2167.
Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Could I speak on this, too? Could I introduce this?
Yeah. Okay, Representative Jensen is going to speak on this bill.
You want to put any time?
No, unless you want me to.
Yeah, it's every three.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you, Madam Chair, and just briefly, I have brought 2886 to you, and there is a dash one amendment that we have in front of us, and I believe there's going to be other people who are going to speak to perhaps some of the more technical points of this, but I would like to point out that we have spent and will continue to spend, I think, in this committee a considerable amount of time, you know, dealing with the question of agricultural land and some of the efforts and measures that have been taken in the past and we are trying to take in the future to preserve agricultural land. And this bill that I brought to the committee is an attempt to do that through or to preserve agricultural land for use in agriculture through some protections to the partitioning of land when it goes into, you know, estates or when there's multiple ownerships of the same property. And that is, you know, basically what the purpose is, to try to ensure the preservation of this land for purposes of agriculture in the future. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen. Senator Nelson, this particular bill that Representative Jensen has spoken on is 2886, and we are delaying that because Senator Nelson has been delayed.
Yes.
So I'm going to set that aside for now, and we're going to go to 2167.
I beg your pardon, Madam Chair.
Okay. 2167, I'm not sure who is presenting this bill. I assume, is it Roy? Okay. Roy Elliker. Welcome. Thank you for your patience this morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name for the record is Roy Elliker, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Legislative Coordinator. On my left, Mr. Steve Denny. He's our Watershed District Manager for the Umpqua District. And today we'd like to address House Bill 2167, which basically removes the sunset clause from the current law and allows the department to continue with this very important landowner wildlife tool. To my prepared testimony that you should have in front of you right now, and I also have attached to the committee's information a what's called a department backgrounder, which lays out in detail the history and the current state of the landowner preference program. And landowner preference referring to preference for the landowner to receive hunting, big game hunting tags to hunt on his own property. That's what that landowner preference phraseology refers to. Madam Chair, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife supports House Bill 2167, which essentially removes the 2001 sunset clause from the current law. Landowner preference program is a very valuable tool for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to assist private landowners with wildlife issues on their own land. First, the landowner preference program allows private landowners and their family members to recreationally hunt for deer and elk on their own land. This has become an important issue for many landowners since the department went to what's referred to or known as a controlled hunt program, primarily on the east side of the state, where, as many of you know, hunters have to apply through an application process to hunt in a certain unit in an area where we use a controlled hunt program. Second, the landowner preference program is an important tool to help reduce wildlife damage to agricultural crops. Reducing wildlife damage to private lands is a constant challenge for the department. LLP is one of several department programs that are valuable to the landowner in this regard. The latest changes to this important program occurred in 1995 legislature expanded the program to allow the transfer of some of these landowner preference tags to non-family members and to exchange unused landowner preference tags in a ratio of 1-to-2, to help in animal damage complaints. And if you look at the background, page, on the first page, as to the issues, it explains that in a little bit more detail. In summary, removal of the sunset clause will continue to provide ODFW with a valuable tool to assist private landowners in making sure that they have a family hunting tradition on their own property and containing wildlife damage. And I've asked Mr. Steve Denny today from our Roseburg office to talk about some specific examples of how we work with landowners on these issues.
Thank you, Chair Close, members of the committee. Just a little bit of background on the landowner preference system. 10 to 12, 15 years ago, landowners were in a position if they had wildlife damage to their property, we had to use emergency hunt lists and other techniques to help them resolve their problem, which meant that they took people that they didn't know and trust, often from outside the county area in order to, or the southwest area, to resolve damage issues. And so the landowner preference system has given us a real valuable tool in the field to allow landowners, number one, to help resolve their own problems with people they know and trust on their own lands. And then if they're having damage on their property and they have unused tags, allows us to exchange those 2-for-1, so they basically get the double the number of tags to help resolve the damage on their property. And down in our area in southwest Oregon, we use this tool an awful lot on elk primarily. It's primarily to agricultural crops, Christmas trees, improved pastures, some row crops and orchards. And what this tool has done is allowed us to help resolve problems that we've never been able to resolve satisfactorily with the landowner before. And so removing the sunset would definitely continue the tool that we've been using. And we use it probably the 2-for-1 exchange and the non-family members probably more than anywhere in the state. Well over 300 landowners that we work with down there on a yearly basis that we either exchange tags or provide LOP tags to resolve damage. So I say it's a valuable tool. It helps the landowner. It helps us work with the landowner to help resolve their problems. So I would urge that we remove the sunset and continue on with the program. It's very valuable to us.
Can I ask you, I have had problems on my own land with a herd of 5 deer showing up, and they just go around the house and munch everything right down. Under this program, you'd have to have prior tags to destroy one animal. Is that true? And would you be limited? How many would you be limited to 2 then?
Well, first off, there's some acreage minimums on there. You need to have at least 40 acres in Western Oregon in order to be able to get these types of tags. If there's a controlled hunt that encompasses your land and you have more than 40 acres, you qualify for a landowner preference tag in that hunt. And in our case down there, when someone has damage, they call one of our biologists. We go out, inspect the damage, verify the damage is occurring, and then if there's an ongoing hunt, we can issue the landowner preference tag. If you've already have a controlled hunt that's for your property and it's and you haven't used that tag, then you can exchange it for the 2-for-1 exchange, which would double the number of tags on your property.
So if you have 5 acres, you're what, out of luck?
Well, Chair Close, there's other methods that we can use to help resolve the problem. And we've got fencing programs, we have hazing permits, we have kill permits that we can issue, a whole variety of tools in addition to the landowner preference system to help resolve those types of problems.
Well, I have used your blood mill program, and wasn't real effective.
We get mixed results with blood mill. There's also several other repellents that we use, some of them do require continual application as it wears out or gets weathered and that sort of thing. We have used fencing programs in the past, which are pretty effective. They're somewhat expensive. So we try to work through a whole variety of, I guess, tools that we use until we hit something that works to the satisfaction of the landowner. And some of those garden variety deer damage problems where people want to raise roses or other flowers are very difficult to deal with because they're usually on very small acreages and or in town or in a subdivision, and it does remove some tools that we have to help resolve the damage.
Questions? Okay, thank you very much. Next we have Pete Test, Oregon Farm Bureau.
Chair Close, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to comment on this sunset bill to eliminate, repeal the sunset. The Oregon, for the record, I'm Pete Test, Associate Director of Governmental Affairs, and I'm all crossed up with my words this morning.
You're all crossed up.
And I can make this real simple. We really support repealing the sunset. This process has made the landowner preference tag situation and has been very well accepted by our members and landowners that we work with. It has helped reduce some of the conflict and concerns related to wildlife damage. We've also worked with the Fish and Game since they started working on the repeal to look into some processes where they could help make the administration of the program a little simpler for the landowners and the hunters involved. They've cooperated, and most of those efforts will be done through rule and administration, and they're working quickly to try and do that. Among the things they're trying to do is develop a manual for landowners and hunters to explain the program a little more simply, and also explanations of other programs that are available for depredations, similar to what the chairman was concerned about, as well as working with efforts to make the application easier and not so bulky and have to be happened every year. A lot of people have the same family members doing the same hunt. They shouldn't have to do the application over and over again. The department's working quickly on these changes to help us out, and we really appreciate their effort. And with that, we support this. This program has worked to help make the LOP program better for our people. And we appreciate the effort on the part of the Fish and Game and the hunting community to help work together to make this thing work. Appreciate this opportunity, and I'll answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Tess? Okay, thank you very much. Sue Barlin.
Representative Close, Chair, my name is Steve Byerlin. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Guides and Packers, past President of the Guides and Packers, and I just wanted to throw the Guides and Packers voice behind this bill to repeal the landowner preference tag, and not to repeal it, I'm sorry, to repeal a sunset, you know. Pete got me going. We have watched this program from the start. We were involved in the original landowner preference tag program, and we stay involved with it and work with the department and the landowners. Anything that's going to help the landowners to alleviate some of their problems with wildlife on their land and give them some kind of recourse, we're all for. And I'm just going to keep it short. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Barlin? Thank you. Next, we have Al Elkin and Sandy Sanderson. Is that correct? Sanderson. Excuse me.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Al Elkins. I'm representing the Oregon Hunters Association. With me today is Sandy Sanderson, past president of the Oregon Hunters Association. We support this bill. I'd just like to let you know that we were involved in July and August as part of a 10-meeting focus group process around the state where landowners and hunters got together to discuss the continuation of this program and the program in its essence and how it was working. It was favorable. The reactions of most of the focus groups, of all the focus groups, actually were favorable to the continuation of the program. Mr. Test pointed out two points that came up having to do with the administration of the program, and it's our understanding the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has already taken those into consideration and is making the program less bureaucratic, and we applaud these efforts. That pretty much sums up what we'd like to say. We are in support of removing the sunset, and we'd be glad to answer any questions.
I guess just briefly, could you tell me, you said you've made it less bureaucratic. What exactly was the...
There were some concerns, Madam Chair, there were some concerns with the form filling out process by both landowners and hunters, and I think that the ODFW has streamlined that. And then there was also a request by a number of people that a manual be written, a step-by-step procedure on how to apply for tags, and it's my understanding that someone is doing that as well. And it was stressed that someone outside the agency, a non-bureaucratic type person, write the manual, and I think they are searching to find someone to do that as well. So we applaud their efforts.
I'm sure there's someone somewhere.
Yes, I'm sure there is, too. Madam Chair, I would be remiss in not saying that we do have some concerns with the language of the bill, and I know that there are some people that are going to talk about some of the bold areas in the bill itself, the body of the bill that you have before you, and they can speak more to that than I can, but we are very much in support of any technical changes to the bill that need to be made, and we are very much in support of the concept of the bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. Rod Harder.
Chair Close, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rod Harder. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Sportsman's Defense Fund. Like a lot of other bills around here, I worked on the original bill that put the LOP into play. Background on the bill was when the controlled hunt system went into place, there were landowners who were not allowed to hunt on their own property. They would put in for controlled hunt tags. Tags would be drawn. They wouldn't get one. And so they were sitting there opening day of the hunting season for elk or deer and not being able to hunt on 1,000 acres or 2,000 acres. That being unfair, we put this process into motion, and along the way, it's been amended a couple times, one to allow the transfer of tags, another to get access and habitat board tags, two for access, two for habitat. Program has worked extremely well for landowners, and hunters like the access part. As with Mr. Elkins, we have some small problems with some of the language in the bill. I understand that someone from LC is here today to talk about those. We are very much in favor of removing the sunset on this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that the panel may have.
Thank you, Mr. Harder. I'm trying to find the copy of the amendment.
We don't have any.
Okay.
Chair Moniz Anderson, someone from LC is here to, I understand, to explain those.
Excellent. All right. Are there any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Harder. Is Representative Greg Smith here? Okay.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Megan Berg, and I'm testifying on behalf of Representative Greg Smith today. He wrote a letter that I was reading. Dear Chairwoman Close and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Representative Greg Smith from District 59. I am testifying today in support of House Bill 2167, which allows for the removal of the sunset on the landowner preference tag program. I do understand, however, there are a few minor changes that need to be made to this bill, and that these changes are currently being reviewed by various groups. House Bill 2167 is a good bill because it will continue to give landowners the opportunity to hunt on their own property. I believe this bill will continue to help the people in my district, and I'm in full support of its concept. Thank you for your time and opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much, Megan. Are there any questions for Megan? All right. Roy, do you want to go over some of the amendments that are being proposed at this point in time?
Representative Monis Anderson, members of the committee, there are some changes that need to be done to the bill at this point. The legislative counsel here, Brendan McCarthy, is here, and perhaps this is when he should come up. There are some changes that, frankly, the supporters of the bill would like to make sure we're doing exactly all we want to do, which is just repeal the sunset. Apparently, when it was in Ledge Council, there was some rewriting and bringing together of some various parts to make it the law a little cleaner, but there may have been some omissions at that time of some key words, and so Brendan can go over those at this point.
For the record, Brendan McCarthy with the council's office. I guess a general review of this, how my changes came about, might be useful. Last summer when the department asked for this bill, they just suggested repealing the sunset, and at the time I had discussions with them saying that it might be useful to clean up some of the language in an existing statute, 496-146, which is relates generally to the powers of the commission. In 496-146 sub 4, that gives the commission the authority to issue licenses, tags, and permits, and then that subsection sort of just goes on and starts talking about the landowner preference tags. And as far as my logic was concerned, I didn't feel as though it really belonged in the powers of the commission and sort of belonged in its own section. And since we were repealing the sunset of the other portion of the landowner preference tags, it was an opportunity to create a new statute section that would deal completely with landowner preference tags. My effort was, it was an attempt to keep all the language the same, but apparently, at least in two small places, I can see improvements that might be made to the original effort. So do you want me to go into them now, or?
Have you talked with the other groups regarding these?
Well, I've talked with Roy.
Okay, but the Farm Bureau or Oregon Hunters Association, they're not aware of what these proposed changes are.
I haven't talked with any other groups to any great extent.
Okay. Fine. I would assume that we go ahead and have those proposed, and they can be brought forward in the future, as long as you get input from other groups also.
Thank you, Representative. That's at this point in time, because there's a couple of there's at least two omissions of key words or words that might be important. It might be useful for us. In the last 24 hours, the office have been kind of staring at this bill at this point, and so it might be good if we took a day or so, allow us to work with Brendan, let us bring back an amended version, some amendments to clean that, to make sure it does exactly what everybody wants it to do, and then move forward from there.
Can I turn it over to the Representative Colvin?
Thank you. I apologize. Hearing that exchange, but I understand there are amendments that we will be working on. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. Questions? Thank you. Katie Kate Cattleman.
Thank you, Chair Close and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Katie Kate, representing the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. The Cattlemen's Association believes strongly in the landowner preference tag program. Since private landowners feed the majority of the state's wildlife, it is a very important program to help relieve some of the burden that landowners face to damage that wildlife causes. While the program does not adequately attempt to compensate the landowners for their financial loss to their agricultural crops, we still believe it's a very important program and urge that the sunsets repealed. There are needs for the process to be more streamlined in the application and also in some of the management programs, which we believe ODFNW are addressing many of the landowners' concerns and are working on our program, and we urge them to continue to do so. I was not aware that there were amendments being drafted. I don't believe any of the agricultural community has been approached on those, and I'd be interested in continuing to look at those and coming forward and testifying again regarding them. And with that, I can answer any questions.
Questions for Katie?
Thank you.
Last witness, Jim Welsh, Oregon Family Farm Association.
Chair and committee members, Jim Welsh, representing for Oregon Family Farm Association, and we just wanted to let you know that we support landowner preference tag program, and for the same reasons that Katie Kate and the cattlemen support this. And we will continue to work with them to strengthen the program and strengthen the relationship between private property owners and hunters, which most of us are. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Wells? Thank you very much. That completes our list of witnesses for House Bill 2167. And we will adjourn the hearing on this bill, close the hearing, excuse me, and we will await the amendments that have been discussed. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2886, and Representative Jensen, we are waiting for Senator Nelson. Could you again tell us, well, why don't we have the staff introduce the bill, and then if you could give us a supplementary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2886 requires the court to consider agricultural land policy when deciding whether to order a partition or sale of land in exclusive farm zone. And this act applies to all suits for partition, whether commenced before or on or after the effective date of this act, unless final decree has been entered. Thank you.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and my apologies for getting off on the wrong foot. It seemed like the Farm Bureau was a little bit having trouble with their words, and the representative was having trouble with his numbers this morning. So, House Bill 2886 was introduced by the Committee on Stream Restoration and Species Recovery. It was drafted at my request, and it has to do with, as the staff has pointed out, the partition of land in exclusive farm use areas. The issue is to try, one of the major issues is to try to make sure we have a preservation of our farm use of our farm use land for farm purposes. Frequently, or on occasion at any rate, there's partitioning of land which results in land being taken out of production, and certainly it is been the intention of this legislature, and it's been the intention of previous legislatures to try and preserve the farmland of the state for that specific purpose, that is farmland. And this is one of the basic intentions that we have with this bill. And I see that Senator Nelson is here, and I think he has some specific comments, and others will too on it. So.
Thank you.
Move all forward. Senator Nelson, welcome. And we apologize that you have to come back twice.
I'm just happy to be here, and thank you, Chair, for making accommodations for me. I appreciate that very much. My name is David Nelson, the state senator from Pendleton, representing District 29, which is about 3 1/4 counties. And as we get into redistricting, we'll see what happens there.
3 1/4 going for 5, huh?
Going for 5. How much bigger will we get out in Eastern Oregon?
We could get you into Multnomah County.
That's what we're telling everybody. If you don't start showing up, you're going to be representing Multnomah County. So, from Eastern Oregon, that's good. I'm here to testify on House Bill 2886, partially from a personal viewpoint, because my family has been involved in one of these things where you have a partition action, and basically it breaks up the family, or has the potential to break up the family. And I know in the Portland area, the NATO family is undergoing one of these things. And while this bill probably doesn't address anything that's going on there, I think it's a statewide issue. More and more of these things are happening as the land is transferred down through the generations, and you end up with these family conflicts. And so my intent here to testify for this bill is to bring an old statute up to date, modernize it, take into consideration what Oregon's land use policy is, and to provide a procedure for helping to resolve these conflicts. Right now, the basic law on this is that it's great prejudice is the standard, and by and large, it's usually a financial standard. And each individual case is a little bit different. It doesn't really address the land use issues of keeping farmland in large tracts. As I see the statute now, it's a statute that really causes conflict, and that's really my main goal in this whole process. Somehow to resolve that. And I think if you look at the proposed amendments, the dash ones, it talks about a three-step plan after you follow the policy, which is outlined in on line 6, following the policy outlined in Oregon Revised Statutes 215-243. That's the keeping farmland in large blocks. Starting on line 6, there are, it's line 18 where we get into the plan of it, 3A. You would include other evidence, actual farm use, the nature and extent of the interest, the probable impact, and then actually requiring the party sit down and try and develop a farm plan. I just think this is a really very important bill to be considering, just from the viewpoint that if you can reduce the conflict that exists in these situations, you're going to be doing a great service to families and to the farmers in the state of Oregon. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. There's people that are probably a lot smarter. We've involved the Oregon Bar Association with this. We've involved 1,000 Friends of Oregon, Oregonians in Action, the Farm Bureau. We're trying to get a broad-based support so that everybody looks at this issue to make sure that we're not creating some unintended consequences. And so I'm willing to work with those folks just to try and make a process much clearer and much cleaner.
I guess I have a question, Senator Nelson. When there's a will in a case like this, how will the circuit court handle it under the existing law right now? How will they handle if different parties want different uses of the land?
Well, if there's a will, you divide it under the terms of the will. And a lot of these cases end up being is like an undivided interest. Say there's 4 children, and each child gets a 25% interest in the land. Okay, who's going to end up being the farmer? And I think that's what this is trying to resolve. I mean, the will, it would not have any effect upon the will and the disposition. It would be after the estate would be settled. Then instead of having one owner, you have 4 owners. So how do you resolve that conflict? Particularly when one of the family members or one of the sons or daughters says, well, you know, I want this use to be done with this. Another one says, no, we can't do that. Or maybe one of the partners or one of the sons or daughters has been farming the land all that time, and all of a sudden they may be losing that potential. To me, it's this law or this proposed bill would help resolve those problems. So, you know, it's probably not going to do it 100%, but at least it gives a little bit bigger framework and some sort of outline rather than just saying great prejudice. You know, one of the things that I've heard that could be a great idea is that in one of these plans you could use a 1031 exchange. You know, where say one of the siblings had some property at a certain place and wanted to use it for a certain thing. Instead of having to sell it, you could exchange it for property, and then maybe another brother, another sister could buy out your share, but you'd still be able to have some ownership and some property. I mean, what I'm looking for is flexibility in this thing, and I don't think the existing law has that.
Could you explain to us the concept of great prejudice? Oh.
I wish I could. It's usually financial. Will the splitting of the property cause financial problems? And, I mean, you're kind of caught in a two-way situation there. If you're making too much money, then they say, well, you can surely get rid of some of this land. But if you're not making enough money, you're just kind of getting by, which I think a lot of basically wheat farmers do in this day, they're living off the government by and large. They say, well, you don't need it. But it's like in our situation, we have a family farm that's about 100 years old. And somehow we've survived through a depression and a couple of world wars and ups and downs and all that sort of thing. I mean, farmers have a way of figuring out how to survive. But if you split out, you know, 25% of the land, then I think you develop a problem, because that cuts into your base. Because if you talk about buying machinery, you know, with cost per acre, you know, the lower your cost per acre, the better off you're going to be. And so that's really the issue. The great prejudice test, they do include sentimental reasons on occasion that can be included, but that's not the primary test. The primary test is financial. And then you get into things like, well, do you look at it on a year's basis or an accrual basis? You know, because we do our tax reporting for different reasons. I can't really explain great prejudice, and I think that's probably the problem, is that judges have a hard time with it, too.
I see. Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Joan Wilkinson, Farm Bureau.
Chairman Close, members of the committee, my name is Jean Underhill Wilkinson, and I'm an Associate Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. This is the first time I think I've been in front of this committee this session. There's a lot of different House committees this time. They're separated, and I've been doing a lot of my work in the Agriculture and Forestry Committee. But I'm pleased to be in front of you today to testify in support of House Bill 2886. The Farm Bureau supports House Bill 2886 because it encourages Oregon courts to consider the agricultural uses of land and to maintain those uses when it must decide whether property should be partitioned or sold under Oregon's partition statutes. And I can very briefly explain what those partition statutes are, and I'll make this short, and because you've received some great testimony already today. And this is a fairly simple bill, and I think you've got the gist of what it's about, and hopefully you can see that it's positive. My interest, I do have a personal interest in this issue. I come from a wheat family, long-established wheat family, south of the Dalles, surrounding a town called Dufour in Wasco County. My family has been there, homesteaded there, and I worked on the farm as I grew up, and now I'm a part owner in that farm. Well, on my mother's side, we have some farm property in Sherman County on the Deschutes River, and my mother's siblings acquired ownership of the property along with my mother, after my grandfather passed away. My grandfather had written his will in such a way that the property was given to the heirs in an undivided interest. Well, one of those siblings passed away, and the property was then handed down to that sibling's three children. So you're getting property ownership that is spread out amongst a number of people. My mother had three siblings. So you're talking about multiple owners now. Besides my mother, all those owners had no interest in farming or agriculture whatsoever, and were detached from the agriculture industry, and wanted the property sold, and wanted out of it, and they wanted their cash. So the property went into a partition action. The siblings sued our family, wanting the property partitioned or sold. It has been litigated now for 10 years. The litigation started in 1991, and it's still hung up in the court system and probably will be for yet a couple more years. So families who own property are more frequently using Oregon's partition laws. When there are multiple owners, like I have told you about our family situation, of a single piece of property, and those owners no longer want to own the property together, such as the heirs of a family farm, one or more owners can file a partition lawsuit against the other owners under ORS 105.205. Many people don't recognize that those laws exist. When a partition suit occurs, the court must receive evidence by the parties as to whether the property should be partitioned amongst the owners, meaning divided amongst the owners, or whether the property should be sold at a public auction. And when I say public auction, that doesn't mean a private sale, how a farm property is normally sold. That means a public auction on courthouse steps, which is a very difficult way to sell farm property. Sometimes partition suits result in the division of property into smaller pieces and a loss of the agriculture value of that property. House Bill 2886 would add an element to the court's consideration during partition suits. That is, the consideration would be the maintenance of the property for agricultural use. House Bill 2886 establishes the method by which the court would receive that evidence by the owners as to the agricultural uses of the property. And all the owners would have the opportunity to present evidence as to the agriculture uses of the land, the impacts on the value of the land for agricultural purposes if the land were divided or sold, and the nature and extent of each owner's interest. If there was more than one owner who wanted to continue farming the property and to purchase the other owner's interests out, the court could receive evidence regarding how the owners plan to farm that land through an agricultural plan like Senator Nelson was just explaining. The owner with the farm plan that was determined to be the most economically viable would be given some preference by the court and would have the opportunity to purchase that the other interest holder shares of that property. So that's briefly what the bill does. I think it's a positive step. It doesn't mandate that the court do anything in additional, but it puts a policy into place in statute that the court would use while the court analyzes and uses these partition laws so that the court will rightfully so look at the agricultural uses and accept evidence as to the agricultural uses of the land and how the court's actions will impact those agricultural uses and the agricultural value of the property. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I hope that you will be in support of House Bill 2886 as well.
Questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Carrie Kirschner.
Good morning, Chair Close, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carrie Kirschner. I'm a staff attorney at 1000 Friends of Oregon. As Senator Nelson indicated, we have been able to provide or been included somewhat in the process. I had not actually seen the proposed amendments until this morning. I know many things are being sort of drafted as they can be right now, and that's not a criticism, but just dictates what the extent of my comments are going to be this morning. In the current law, as it's currently written, I want to make sure that we're clear that this is a partition action and a separate sort of from the partitioning of land that occurs actually under our land use statutes. So really what judges are doing in this process is they are apportioning interests in the land or dictating what might occur. In this process, I do believe that it would be quite valuable to consider the agricultural policy of the state of Oregon. I think it's an appropriate place for that discussion to occur, an appropriate place for evidence, as exemplified by the two personal examples that were given to the committee this morning, an appropriate place for those discussion and policy interests to occur. I might also suggest that part of this process be actually in line 5, subsection A, where it states that the court shall follow the policy outlined in ORS 215-243. It might also be appropriate to designate 215-780, which is the minimum lot size statute. That might just add some additional clarity in this process. What can happen, as another hypothetical, is that the judge can say, oh, you know, we're going to partition the land. You have 40 acres, you have 40 acres, but it's actually in an area where there's an 80-acre minimum lot size requirement. It needs to go through the land use process, which says, no, you can't really divide or partition the land that way in terms of the real estate use and the land use designation or definition of the term partition. And so adding both of these references to the partition action statutes might provide some additional clarification that I do believe would be beneficial not only to individual people going through this process, but as Representative Jensen indicated, to the preservation of our agricultural land to assure its productivity and viability in the state of Oregon. I know my comments are very general. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have, and I thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Questions? I just want to make clear that the Dash 1 amendment appeared on our desk this morning as well. We did not have this any earlier.
Oh, no. Chair Close, I appreciate that. I was kindly given an additional copy, actually, by Representative Jensen's staff this morning. My hesitancy is that I am not an expert in partition actions, and that leaves me to testifying on the policy.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen.
If I may, just to the amendments arrived on the representative's desk this morning, too, and we were in negotiations up till some 6 o'clock last night before we finally got what we thought was the right language, and then the LC still made a couple tweaks, which is okay, but... So the sponsor of the bill is equally perhaps caught by some surprise.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Everybody's working very hard right now.
Burning the midnight oil.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, that completes our witnesses for 2886. We're closing the public hearing on 2886. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3343. And our first witness is Stonebrink, the Oregon Cattleman, from Glenn.
Thank you, Chair Close, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink, the Oregon Cattleman Association. In an act of Congress that granted statehood to Oregon, in that act it also granted the ownership and control of the waters to the state of Oregon, and I've provided you the language in the handout that gives that ownership and control to the state. Water and use of water and the storage of water was not only granted to the state, but during the history of the movement to the West, there were a lot of promises and sometimes projects provided. Mainly these were provided by the federal government to entice settlers to move to the West and utilize that water and create wealth for the West as well as for the nation. As we observe the waters, usually in Western Oregon, come from the sky, we really think, you know, we should say that we're blessed with all this water. But oftentimes we don't manage these waters properly, and we could be doing a better job than we are. But having said that, the waters that are available to the state, there has been an ongoing movement for the federal government to obtain water rights and water control of our waters, the state of Oregon's waters. They want to obtain the water and the water rights and the control. This bill is very simple. It simply prohibits the state from granting any future, doesn't go back and undo anything that's already been done, but from granting any future water or water rights, water control to the federal government. We believe that this is probably, we've probably gone too far, but we're trying to draw the line right here. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, Representative Hess.
I have a few questions. Thank you, Madam Chair. Has the United Nations ever asked the state for water rights?
Chair Close, Representative Haas, as far as I know, the United Nations has not at this time. But we have seen areas like around Yellowstone National Park where the United Nations has been granted an involvement with the lands and the buffers around Yellowstone National Park, and other non-governmental organizations representing the United Nations that have been involved with that, and so we just wanted to make sure that we've covered all bases in this arena.
Well, I guess, Madam Chair, my question would be, if for whatever unlikely reason that the United Nations wanted water rights in Oregon, wouldn't you want to support a president and the federal government in helping out whatever kind of national crisis that may cause that to occur?
Chair Close, Representative, I would have to say no, because this is a bill that would be, by some, and probably myself, a bill that would bring attention to states' rights. The federal government, when it was formed, our founding fathers very wisely limited the scope of the federal government. And in fact, it is spelled out exactly what the role of the federal government is. And unless it's specifically spelled out in the Ninth and Tenth Amendments of the U.S. Constitution, all of those rights are retained to the state and to the people of those states. The idea was that we weren't going to have a central federal government to control all things. So everything else is to belong to the people and to the states. As it says, we are a bunch of states. We are united. But then there's only a core amount that the federal government is to do. We've moved from that to where we believe that the federal government is all-powerful and all-knowing and all-wise, and that they will make all of the decisions, and the states are simply subservient to the federal government. That was never the intent, and we've gone in that direction. To answer your question specifically, if there was a national crisis, I'm sure that we could, this legislature that would create this law could, if it was a real emergency, could meet in an emergency session and undo this if it was absolutely necessary. This bill is directly intended to stop giving away our waters and water control to the federal government.
Representative Jensen.
I think Glenn has perhaps addressed my question, and that question is in Section 2 of the, or Subsection 2 of Section 1, where the bill provides that the legislature determines that the bill doesn't apply if the legislature determines an emergency exists. And at least in most other cases, with as it's talked about in the bill, I would see that any other agency other than, or any other group other than the federal government would have to be some type of an emergency or some type of a, whether it be an application for water rights as such. So I think he's addressed my question, and I withdraw it.
Okay. Other questions?
Thank you.
Next witness is Tom Byler of the Water Resources Department. Thank you. Morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Close, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Byler. I'm the Senior Policy Coordinator for the Water Resources Department. I appreciate the opportunity to present testimony on House Bill 3343, a measure that would prohibit the Water Resources Department from granting a water right or any other control over the waters of the state to federal government or the United Nations or any entity acting on their behalf. The department opposes this bill. We feel that it would seriously erode state authority over waters of the state. At the outset, I would emphasize my agreement with some of the comments that Mr. Stonebrink made. It, indeed, the state does have ultimate authority and control over waters of the state. That is well established in state law, statute, and rule, as well as federal case law. And there's been plenty of federal case law over this issue, believe me.
Could you give us the oral question on that? Excuse me. Go ahead.
Tom, I appreciate your comments on this, I've attended a number of meetings where the federal agencies, I keep referring to this water as their water.
Chair Close, Representative Jensen, I've attended many meetings where I've heard those comments, too. I've heard those comments from other water right holders as well. The federal government holds around 8,000 water rights that they have gone through the state system to obtain. They are a water right holder like any other water right holder in the state, subject to the terms and conditions of the water right, and must comply with the water laws of the state. The issue is more complicated when looking at the fact that the federal government is a large landowner within this state. And as a landowner, under some federal case law, they are able to assert what are called federal reserved rights, which are, in basic sense, grant of water assumed to be needed for the purposes of the use of that federal land. But even those federal reserved rights must be quantified and approved by the state. So ultimately, the state does have the authority and control over the waters. In responding to Chair Close's question, there is a site in the ORS, I believe it's 537.110, I believe, which clearly states that the waters of the state belong to the public. The statutes further indicate that the Water Resources Department in the state is authorized to allocate and distribute and enforce those laws for the state in terms of how those waters are used. Every water right holder in the state has the right to use that public resource. They don't own the public resource.
Madam Chair.
Same way.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom, my concern on this bill is it would undo the entire Klamath adjudication process, and there's not any way that I can support this bill without very significant changes. Could you explain to the committee what would happen in that adjudication and also potentially the one in the Willamette?
Chair Close, Representative Lee, yes. Representative Lee really is getting to the nub of our concern about this bill, is that if we close off any opportunity for the federal government to either seek a new water right through our state system, or we believe this would also prohibit the transfer of existing rights through our state system, that the federal government would have no option but to seek and assert federal authority to make future uses of water within the state.
Could you explain exert federal authority? What is their federal authority?
Madam Chair, I am not an expert on that particular issue, and I don't have a specific any specific laws to refer to on that. But I guess my point is that currently and historically, the federal government has come through our process in order to obtain water rights. If we shut the door on that, the federal government will have to find some other mechanism in order to use water if they have future needs. I expect they will have future needs at some point in some fashion. And if we shut the door on them in terms of their participation in our system, I would expect that they would have to fashion their own arguments on why they're using water in the future without going through us to do that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hess.
Sorry to interrupt. I just wonder if, before we spend any more time on this, I know that Brandon is in the room to clear up the constitutionality for one and address this issue, too.
We have requested him to come. I think we will take the witnesses in order at this point. We will take him next, under time constraint. Continue.
Chair Close, just to follow up on Representative Lee's question about the Klamath adjudication, this is an adjudication of pre-1909, pre-water code claims of use of water in the Klamath Basin, which include a number of federal reserved right claims for Federal Forest Service, Crater Lake National Park, and other federal lands within that area. We have spent considerable time and effort public funds litigating issues relating to the Klamath adjudication in order to keep the federal government in the state adjudication. By keeping them in the state adjudication, we have, as a state, the ultimate authority in determining the extent and quantifying these rights, these claims to these rights in the Klamath Basin. The concern is that this bill will send a signal to the federal government that we're shutting the door, we're no longer considering any federal claims, and that the federal government will pull out of the Klamath adjudication and seek to have their claims adjudicated in federal court.
Okay. I want to ask you a question about, you mentioned ORF 537-110. And basically what it says is public ownership of the waters, all water within the state of Oregon from all sources of water supply belongs to the public. I guess my question is, who is the public? Is it the state of Oregon or is it the entire United States?
Chair Close, open. And the way that we've considered water rights in the past and to this day, we don't discriminate as to who applies for the water. It could be an individual, it could be a business, it could be a multinational corporation, it could be a local government, it could be an irrigation district, a municipality, a state entity, or the federal government. There's a wide variety of water right holders in this state. Our concern more is based on the statutory and rule criteria involved with considering a water right application. It does not include looking at who is applying for the water right, but instead on the nature of the use, whether it will benefit the state as a whole, and whether there's water available, and whether it's in the public interest to grant that water right for that applicant. I might underscore that of those currently federally held water rights, really involve a wide variety of uses, including reservoirs that are available for the public for recreation purposes, for irrigation, municipal uses, flood control purposes, a lot of uses that serve the Oregonians across the state.
But is the state held to those guidelines, or is that arbitrary? I mean, and that's the way it's been in the past, and that sounds very good, but I guess we're looking at the future.
Chair Close, the laws haven't changed in that regard, and we continue to review any application for a water right in the same manner that we have in the past. Again, not focusing on who's applying, but focusing on whether there's water available and whether they meet the statutory criteria that the legislature has set out.
And can I ask you lastly, 8,000 federal government water rights is what you said. Do you see any problem with that number, 8,000?
Madam Chair, no, I don't personally. There are roughly 80,000 water rights across the state. Most of these water rights, by the way, that are held by federal entities are for stock watering ponds on BLM lands, roughly 3 to 5,000. I can't remember the number exactly. But there's a wide variety of purposes and uses, including the Willamette National Cemetery. Again, I mentioned Crater Lake National Park. Forest Service land hold water rights on those properties for fire protection. So there are a wide variety of uses.
Questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Our next witness is Doug Myers of Water Watch. Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry, Doug. We want to get Brendan up here next. Since we want him down there serving the state of Oregon as soon as possible.
Back at his desk.
Chair Close, members of the committee, thanks for being back this morning. Brendan McCarthy, Legislative Council's office. I agree with what Tom Beiler said about probably about 99% of what he said, or at least I just want to add it to the other 1%. The federal government may hold rights issued by the department, but if the federal government was to obtain land in the state of Oregon through exercise of their constitutional authority to do that, at the time of the reservation, water in sufficient quantities would be reserved to accomplish the purposes of the reservation. And that happens regardless of whether the federal government obtains a state water right or not.
Constitutional authority, can you direct us to the part of the Constitution that says that?
The property clause of the U.S. Constitution gives the federal government the authority to obtain land in states. And if they do so, if there is a national monument declaration or a wildlife refuge declaration or any other creation of a national park, forest, or what have you, then water along with that reservation would be reserved with the land.
One property clause that I have read in the Constitution talks about it has to be approved by the state legislature. Is that correct?
The consent, Chair Close, the consent of the state legislature reflects more on the jurisdiction of the federal government rather than the right of the federal government to obtain the land. The federal government has the authority to obtain the land, but the what happens after the federal government obtains the land is different depending on whether the state consents to that or not. And that is more of a jurisdictional type of situation where if there's a crime committed on the property, who would prosecute, who would be able to look into the crime? Would it be the FBI or would it be the state authority? Those types of more jurisdictional type elements. But the federal government can obtain property in the state regardless of whether the state consents or not.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lee.
Thank you. For reserved water rights that would go with such properties, it's my understanding Congress has to distinctly, in a piece of legislation, set out that reservation. Is that correct?
Chair Close, Representative Lee, that is correct. It is a very fact-specific determination, although there have been determinations of reserved rights.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases without a specific declaration in the enabling legislation passed by Congress. So I can't say that in every case there is a particular portion of the bill creating the federal monument or park, what have you, that says the water is also reserved. But sometimes courts read that into the language of the bill. So you are correct.
Representative Hess.
Thank you. If we pass this legislation into law and the federal government in the future, United Nations, whoever's named here, for some reason said they want to obtain some water rights, what would the effect of this law have?
Tom's still here?
Tom, do you want to come forward?
Chair Close, Representative Hass. In my reading of the statute, or the bill, excuse me, I don't want to get ahead of myself on this, I believe that we would not have the authority to issue a water right to those entities in the future if this were to be enacted.
Other than the emergency clause.
Correct. I stand corrected, yes.
Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen.
I'm reading the proposed bill, but they would not have the right to issue the water right, if I understood what you said. But the probably more pressing question on that is what happens when they go to federal court seeking to declare this law then unconstitutional? But
Representative Jensen, Chair Close, I think that this bill could set up a conflict between the federal government's ability to obtain a reserve water right and the state's denial of a permit. There could be a significant conflict that would be resolved not by us, but by the courts.
The federal courts?
Yes.
Okay. And then I recognize that that we don't have, and you know, probably should be asking for an opinion on this, which would require more time than you have probably already put into it. But the question I would have is how successful would the state of Oregon be in defending its statute?
Chair Close, Representative Jensen, I think that's an incredibly fact-specific situation.
And I appreciate
it. And on the reason why the federal government was trying to obtain the use of waters. I think under a reserved right scenario where land was set aside by the federal government, I think our successes might be, chance of success on that on the state end might be very low, extremely low.
And I appreciate that it would be very AFAC specific and requires you know, more background or research perhaps than you have had time to put in or been requested of, so thank you.
I have a question. If this were to pass with this emergency clause, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm envisioning a process where the federal government has to go through the legislative process. You know, there'd be bills coming before the legislature every 2 years saying that you know, therefore, because of this emergency, this right needs to be granted, and then we vote on that. Is that correct?
I'm not sure of the process that is envisioned by the bill here. I think that there would have to be some regular seeking of approval. It would have to be the whole body of the legislature. It couldn't just be an emergency board. So it would be relatively complicated unless we spaced it out so that it only happened every 2 years.
Would it be theoretically possible to add the emergency board to the language?
Chair Close, I think we're getting into an area where there might be some delegation problems where the legislature is delegating to the agency a situation where it needs to make a determination, but then hauling back portions of that ability and then only having a portion of the legislative body vote on whether to approve a agency action, and that does raise some delegation concerns.
Although that happens all the time with the emergency board, does it not? With agencies coming and asking for
Chair Close,
legislative approval?
That does happen with the emergency board in appropriation scenarios where there is an appropriation made to the emergency board with a further allocation to agencies, and agencies have to come forward and explain why they need the money. But the appropriation, the actual act that appropriates the money, is made first, and then the emergency board is given the authority to allocate that money as it sees fit in a quarterly payment or a bi-yearly payment. So it is a little bit different, because in one case we're asking the agency to come in and explain why it needs more money, and the act has already been passed by the whole House. In this situation, we are giving an agency authority to approve or deny permits for water rights, except in certain circumstances when we're be asking them to come back and get specific approval from less than the whole House. So there is a distinction.
Okay. Thank you. Next witness is Jim Welch. Oh, excuse me. It's Doug Myers of Water Watch. I'm sorry, Jim. We forgot we'd slip Brendan in here. Welcome, Doug.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Doug Myers, and I'm here representing Water Watch and the Klamath Tribes. Speaking to House Bill 3343, federal government rarely gets into state court to decide anything. In the Klamath adjudication, the feds have submitted to state jurisdictions. I want to submit, if they can't get water from the state, as this bill would say, they would go back to fed court. Is this really what the sponsors of the bill really want, the Cattlemen's Association? And secondly, isn't it a good thing that the federal government will go through the state water right process, as complicated as that is? Do we really want the federal government to have their own process for getting water without state involvement? Tom Byler testified there are 3,000 to 5,000 water rights that the federal government holds for stock watering. Do we really want those, do the Cattlemen's Association who use those water rights, do they really want that to be in jeopardy? For all these reasons, we oppose the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think the cattlemen were saying that past rights would not be affected by this. It would be future rights. And I think that their intent is to have some control over the future granting, which probably would not be additional stock watering, but could be.
I don't presume to speak for the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, but I really don't feel that they would have a real problem if any future rights were stopped for stock watering in the future.
Questions? Thank you. Jim Welsh, Oregon Family Farm Association.
Chair Close and committee members, I'm Jim Welsh, representing Oregon Family Farm Association. We support the concept in this bill, absolutely. I think it really gets down to the basic issue of resisting certainly more federal intrusion. But it gets real deep when we start talking about states' rights. You know, we had that argument 100 plus years ago, and both sides of my family lost limbs and lives in that argument, and we still have that going on, I think, in concept many times. But if the department, then our state, our agency, in authority to control the state's water, is granting a right and not the ownership, that's okay in our mind in a lot of respects, and it does resolve some issues, I think, in the adjudication issue too, which is rather sticky when you start talking about going back to court on some of these issues, but I think it was always intended that occur anyway. So that argument goes on too. What we're trying to get to, I think, and I'm not going to speak for the Cattlemen's Association, but those of us, Oregon Family Farm Association, are concerned about, certainly is allowing rights to become ownership in the future. And as we read it, we would not want that to occur, certainly, for an entity outside of the United States. I think if... We know we're going to lose the battle usually to the federal government. We have for a long time. But we still would like to provide a statement that lets them know that we do have some sovereignty, and it wasn't intended many years ago in the development of our country that we maintain that in states' rights. And so we would like to make sure that in the future transactions that the constitutional authority we have over our waters is maintained in the state.
Could you respond to the ORS 537110 comment, question that I had earlier about where it says that the waters belong to the public? I'm wondering if we amend this bill, if we should include language that defines who the public is.
Public being the public of the state.
The public of the state. if that isn't clear, is that a problem?
It may not be. I would say it's not real clear, and we need to maintain that.
Question?
Madam Chair.
Madam Jensen.
Just a comment on that, but in light of the fact that these are the statutes of the state of Oregon, common sense would tell me that we're writing statutes about the public, of the people of the state of Oregon, not the people from Virginia or South Carolina, that it, our statutes are not really applicable to, you know, those other people. So, and I appreciate your question. I appreciate the concern, but I have no idea where a court would go with it, but it just common sense is that we write laws about our state and our people, not about the nation.
Well, I appreciate that, Representative Jensen, but as we go more and more towards a global society and the concept of the people is considered on a global level, it might be something we want to define. Further questions? Comment? Thank you. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3343, and we will intend to amend that bill to take in some of the concerns of the state agency, the Water Resources Department, try to work with them on something that would help them as well. Is there anything else for the good of the state? Hearing nothing, we are adjourned.